walked beside them.
"Where are you off to, young'uns?" Jeremy Prescott rolled down the window.
"Oh, hello, Jeremy," Phoebe said. "We're going into the village to report something serious."
"Serious? Not a lack of champagne for the party, surely?" He laughed. "My father already sent over 6 bottles.
"No, really serious," Alfie said. "Someone might be going to shoot the Prime Minister this afternoon."
"What? Is this some kind of joke?"
Jeremy was still smiling.
"No, not a joke. It's real," Phoebe said.
"How did you figure that one out?"
"Phoebe overheard this morning."
Alfie moved closer to the van so that nobody could overhear.
"A man told a woman she had to do it, and he gave her a loaded gun, and she was very upset."
"Good God. Really?"
Jeremy was no longer smiling.
"You're right. This is serious stuff. We should go and tell the police right away."
He got out and came around the van.
"Jump in. I'll give you a lift."
He had opened the rear door. They scrambled into the back of the van. The door closed behind them.
"Hey, don't shut us in. It's dark in here,"
Alfie shouted, but the van was already driving off again. When it hadn't slowed after a few minutes, Phoebe whispered to Alfie,
"I don't think we're going to the police station, do you?"
"No. We'd better get out of here next time it slows down, okay?"
"Yes, let's. I have a really bad feeling about this."
She slid across to the door and ran her hands over it.
"There doesn't seem to be a way to open it from the inside," she whispered. "Let's bang and shout. Somebody will hear us."
"But he'll hear in the front seat. He might come around and kill us," Alfie said.
"Oh, don't be silly. This is Jeremy. I've known him all my life. He wouldn't ever..."
She paused.
"I don't think he'd kill us,"
she said in a small voice. The van was being driven fast, throwing the children from side to side. At last it slowed and came to a halt. They felt it shake as the driver's door slammed.
"Now!" Alfie whispered to Phoebe. "Bang on the sides and shout. Ready? Go!"
"Help!"
they shouted.
"Let us out!"
They banged with their fists on the sides of the van. Then Alfie noticed something.
"He's left the engine running," he said. "We'd better hope we're not in a garage, or we won't last 5 minutes.
"Don't say that."
Phoebe put her eye to the crack where the doors came together but could see nothing. Alfie gave a sudden sob.
"Oh, God!" he yelled. "Get me out of here!"
He hammered on the door of the van.
"Calm down,"
Phoebe said primly. She put a hand on his back and felt him shaking.
"I hate being shut in like this," he said. "Ever since the door was blown in on the bomb shelter, and we couldn't get out, and everyone was screaming, and I thought we were going to die. I've got to get out."
Phoebe patted his shoulder.
"It's going to be all right, Alfie. We'll find a way."
"How?"
Phoebe looked around, trying to think of something to make him feel better.
"You're a Cockney," she said. "Don't people like you know how to pick locks?"
"Not all people in London are criminals, you know."
He sounded niffed now, but at least he had stopped whimpering.
"Sorry, I didn't mean it like that. I just meant that you've had to do things we never have. Look, I've got bobby pins in my hair," she said.
She took one out and handed it to him.
"Give it a try."
She held her breath until he said,
"It's no use. The lock seems to be on the other side."
"Golly,"
she sighed.
"I can't think what else to do, can you?"
"Keep hoping, I suppose," he said.
"Oh, Pamela, there you are at last, you naughty girl."
Lady Westerham greeted her daughter as the motorbike pulled up outside Farley.
You promised you'd be here to help me. Margot and your friend have been stellar, so helpful, and Dido too.
I'm sorry, Ma. It was a matter of great importance, or I'd never have gone, Pamela said. A matter of national security.
What on earth has national security to do with you? Lady Westrom asked with disdain.
It's no business of yours. Leave such things to the professionals. And for God's sake, go and change before the guests arrive.
Ben was feeling a little better now that they were back at Farley. He had had a word with Colonel Pritchard, who did take him seriously but urged him not to worry. There were plenty of soldiers around. The gate could be guarded, the guests vetted before they came in. But what if the enemy was already inside the gate, Ben worried. He looked down at his rumpled trousers. He realized he was not dressed suitably for a garden party, but there was no time to go home and change. He would make sure he stayed out of sight, in the background, observing. As he walked around to the back lawn, he saw that chairs and tables had been placed under the large copper beech. A long table had been set up on the gravel beside the house. Champagne stood ready in buckets of ice. Plates of sandwiches and cakes were covered in white napkins. A large bowl of strawberries stood next to a jug of cream. Two maids were putting out teacups at one end, while another carried out a tray of glasses. Trixie and Margot came out through open French doors, carrying a large flower arrangement between them. Trixie spotted Ben.
"Oh, you're back! Thank heavens! Lady Westrom was so annoyed. Are you all right?"
"Yes, thank you," he said. "I'm sorry we saddled you with all the work. Unavoidable. Caught in a rainstorm."
"Oh, we managed just fine," Margot said. "I've enjoyed every second. It's wonderful to be part of something like this. Normal life, the way it used to be. One never appreciates it until one doesn't have it. I mean, look at all this food and drink. We were starving in Paris, living on turnip soup and foul bread."
"You must be so glad to be home," Ben said.
"I can't tell you how glad."
Ben looked at her, but Margot didn't meet his gaze.
"But she had to leave her chap behind," Trixie said. "She was telling me all about it. So sad."
"He's probably dead by now," Margot said.
"But he was very brave and wouldn't betray his friends. I admire him for that."
Ben looked at her critically. There were things she was not saying. He was sure of that.
"Now that you're here, I'm putting you in charge of pouring champagne," Trixie said. "I'm hopeless at opening champagne bottles."
"I'm not too hot myself," Ben said.
"And I'm not suitably dressed for a party. We came straight from the West Country." "Did you find what you were looking for?" she asked.
Ben was conscious of Margot standing beside him.
"Not really. False alarm," he said. "It was only an old monastery that had been burned by Cromwell's men."
"What was all this about, then? Some kind of scavenger hunt?" Margot asked.
"No, we were trying to identify a place in a photograph for my boss," Ben said. "I don't think it even matters now. So where do you want to put me to work?"
"I think the maids will need help with that tea urn," Margot said. "It's jolly heavy. We're going up to change."
As he helped position an urn of tea, he looked around. The lawn on which the tables were set was surrounded by a rose arbour, tall topiaries and shrubs. Plenty of cover for someone who wanted to hide. When the others had moved away, he set off on a tour, examining possible hiding places with an easy escape into the woods. Unlike the front of the house, with its lake and lawns giving a view for miles, the rose arbour led to an enclosed rose garden, and then the kitchen gardens, and beyond them a thick stand of yew trees. Plenty of opportunity for a quick gunshot. He shuddered. Why on earth hadn't they held this on the front lawns? Probably because they wanted to be away from the comings and goings of the West Kents, he thought, giving the impression of a serene country house, removed from thoughts of war for once. Pamela appeared at his side, looking serene and lovely in lemon-yellow chiffon and a large white hat trimmed with daisies.
"So Trixie and Margot are upstairs changing right now. Trixie's been an absolute brick. You know, I've always taken her for a bright young thing who'd be useless in a crisis, but she worked jolly hard this morning. And isn't it wonderful to have Margot home? It's a miracle, Ben. You don't know how I've longed for this moment."
Her face, Ben noted, was strained, and her eyes darted around.
"What next?" she asked.
"We wait. The Colonel's men are at the gate. Nobody can get in. We should be all right." She reached out and took his hand.
"God, I hope so. I'm scared, Ben. If Mr. Churchill is killed, the whole country will crumble, won't it?"
"That's obviously what the Germans intend. We must make sure..." He stopped. How could he tell Pamela that he suspected her beloved sister? Lord and Lady Westram came out, she looking incredibly regal in purple flowery silk and a feathered purple hat.
"Well, I think we've done it," she said to her husband. "Now all we do is wait for guests."
At that moment, the dogs rushed up, barking hysterically.
"Be quiet! Get down, you stupid beasts!" Lord Westram bellowed.
He motioned to Soames, who was hovering in the doorway.
"Take them inside and shut them up. I don't know what has got into them. They are normally so well behaved."
One by one, the guests began to arrive, Colonel and Mrs. Huntley bringing Miss Hamilton from the village, Sir William and Lady Prescott, the Musgroves, Colonel Pritchard from the West Kents. Ben noted that he was armed today.
"I've brought a few of my men to help out where needed, Lady Westram," he said.
"How kind, but I think we have everything under control," Esme said.
Margot and Trixie came down together. Margot was wearing a light, tailored, form-fitting dress that was obviously the height of Parisian fashion. Ben examined her, deciding there was nowhere to hide a weapon. She didn't even carry a purse. Pamela went over to Trixie.
"Are you all right? You look rather washed out."
"I'm not feeling too wonderful, but I'll be fine," Trixie said. "A bit of a migraine. I might go and lie down as soon as the party starts. Nobody will miss me."
"I'll miss you. You've been a real brick," Pamela said.
Trixie smiled.
"That's me, Trixie the Brick."
"I should disappear too," Ben said to Pamela. "I can't let the great man see me looking like a dishevelled farm labourer."
"I think you look just fine," Pamela said, and she gave him an entrancing smile.
Ben slipped into the shadows between the bushes. A figure was standing behind the rose arbour. A woman dressed in bright red pyjamas. Ben crept up to her. It was Dido.
"What are you doing?" he asked.
She jumped guiltily when she heard him.
"Oh, it's only you, Ben," she said. "If you must know, I'm sneaking a cigarette. Pa doesn't know that I smoke, but I felt that I needed something to calm my nerves before I face everyone."
Ben looked up. "I can hear voices," he said. "I think the PM has arrived. You'd better go and be visible." Dido gave an exaggerated smile.
"I suppose, if I must, I must," she said.
As Ben watched Dido walk away in her sexy red pyjamas, he heard someone coming through the rose garden. He spun around to see Guy Harcourt coming toward him.
"What are you doing here?"
Ben's voice was sharp.
"I did say I might come and crash the party, didn't I?"
He grinned.
"Actually, I came with the advance party to make sure all was well for the PM, old boy. Have you been keeping an eye on Lady Margot?"
She's wearing such a skimpy dress that she couldn't have a weapon on her, Ben said. He examined Guy as he was speaking. Wasn't that a gun holster under Guy's jacket? Should he say something? It all seemed quite unreal. He decided to find the colonel and tell him to watch Guy.
"Ah, champagne! Jolly good!" Guy said. "I thought this assignment might have its perks."
He left Ben and headed for the table where champagne was now being poured into flutes. Applause and cheers announced the arrival of Winston Churchill. Ben could see the great man coming around the house and walking toward the back lawn with Lord Westerham at his side. Clementine Churchill and Lady Esme walked together, chatting. Then Ben heard a voice coming from the shrubbery behind him.
"Are you there?"
The words were hissed, and it was impossible to tell if it was a man or a woman. Ben crept in the direction of the voice.
"I can't do it! I told you!"
Ben came around a large, flowering bush and saw Trixie standing on the other side. A gun was in her hand, but she was turned away from the Prime Minister, and she was shaking.
"Take it! I don't want it! I don't want any part of it!"
She held out the gun to someone standing in the deep shadow. Then, to Ben's amazement, Jeremy stepped out and snatched the gun. He said in a low voice,
"You absolute weakling! You're not one of us. You'll regret it."
He moved into the open to get a clear shot at the approaching Prime Minister. Churchill was now in full view, some 25 yards away. As Ben heard Jeremy cock the gun, he stepped out in front of him.
"Get out of the bloody way! I don't want to shoot you, old man," Jeremy said. His eyes had a wild look to them.
"If you want to shoot Churchill, you'll have to shoot through me," Ben replied.
"Jeremy, no!"
Ben heard Pamela's scream as she rushed toward them. Jeremy glanced in her direction, taking his focus away from the Prime Minister for an instant. Ben took his chance and went for the gun, knocking it upward as it fired. He let out a cry as the force of the bullet threw him to the ground. He was conscious of everything happening in slow motion, Pamela screaming,
"How could you? You betrayed us all!"
She dropped to her knees beside Ben while Guy and the soldiers converged on them. They were looking down at him. Pamela was stroking his hair.
"Don't die," she whispered. "Please don't die."
"I'll be all right," Ben managed a brave smile. In truth, he didn't feel any pain, just strange and far away and warm with the feel of Pamela's hand on his forehead.
"I think he just winged my shoulder."
He tried to sit up.
"I must go after him. Can't let him get away."
Then he fainted. Chapter 39 In a Van in Farley Wood. Phoebe and Alfie lay sprawled, sleeping in the locked van. They had tried anything possible to attract attention, to kick their way out, but had given up in despair. The sides of the van were smooth metal, and nobody could hear them. The van rattled and hummed as the engine ticked over. Fumes began to seep up, making their eyes water.
"Someone will notice I'm missing and come looking for me soon," Phoebe said, trying to sound encouraging.
"But what if we're parked miles from anywhere? What if we're in the middle of a field or even in a garage?"
Alfie said. Phoebe put her ear to the side of the van.
"I don't think we're in a building. I think I can hear birds."
"How much air do you think we have?" Alfie asked.
Phoebe looked at the tiny sliver of daylight where the doors closed. She didn't really think that it could help them much, but she knew it was her job to stay calm and positive. She was bred to be a leader, and leaders didn't show they were scared.
"I think we'll be fine," she said.
And it's probably better that air can't get in, because then the fumes can't get in either.
Cheerful thought, Alfie said, making her laugh in spite of everything. At one point, their hopes were raised. They heard the sound of dogs sniffing around the van and then barking.
Those barks sound like our dogs. Good boys, Phoebe shouted. Go for help.
She turned to Alfie.
See? We can't be too far away. We might even be at Farley. They'll be here soon.
They hammered, kicked and yelled again, but nobody came. After a while, they lapsed into silence.
Alfie, you're not falling asleep, are you? Phoebe asked.
Bloody tired, he muttered. Can't seem to stay awake. Phoebe shook him.
You can't fall asleep. You absolutely can't. Do you hear me?
Alfie just mumbled something unintelligible. Phoebe's own head was singing.
Must not sleep, she kept saying.
But in the end, she too had passed out. They were roused by the van shaking and the slamming of a door. Phoebe couldn't remember where she was for a moment. Her head felt woozy, as if she had been drugged. When she tried to sit up, she was thrown back against the door as the van took off. It was clear it was being driven very fast. Then something struck the back of the van with a loud crack.
"Golly, I think someone's shooting at us!" Phoebe shouted, shaking Alfie. "Wake up, but stay down low!"
Alfie mumbled again, still half-drugged. They pressed themselves to the floor, being flung from side to side as the van drove around bends. But there were no more gunshots. Alfie roused himself and tried to sit up.
"Look," Alfie said, awake now and wriggling toward the door. "The bullet made a hole in the door. That's good. We can breathe fresh air." "Not while we're being tossed around like this," Phoebe said. "Golly, I hope they don't shoot at us again. I feel sick, don't you?"
"I feel bleeding terrible," he muttered.
"Don't swear," Phoebe said, secretly glad that he was awake and talking to her.
The drive seemed to go on forever.
"Do you think he's driving to the Channel to meet a German submarine?" Alfie asked. "I don't know. We don't know if he's the German spy, do we?"
"What else would he be?" Alfie said.
"He only locked us in the van when he knew you'd overheard about the gun."
Phoebe nodded.
"Yes, he must be. I find it so hard to believe. He's Jeremy. I've known him all my life. He's one of us. How could he possibly behave this way?"
"The Germans must have forced him to work for them when he was in the prison camp."
"No true Englishman could be forced to work for Germans," Phoebe said hotly. "They'd rather die first."
"Let's hope he doesn't want to die now and is planning to drive us off a cliff," Alfie said.
"Why do you always have to be so cheerful?" Phoebe snapped.
Then there was a crash as they hit something. The van rocked but didn't slow. Then it screeched to a halt. A door slammed. Suddenly their door was wrenched open. Bright daylight flooded in and fresh air. They sat up, gulping and blinking.
"You're still alive,"
Jeremy said, sounding more surprised and relieved than angry. He reached in and grabbed Phoebe by the hair, dragging her out of the van.
"Come on, you're coming with me."
She screamed, blinking in the bright light, her legs wobbly and not wanting to support her as he set her on her feet. Alfie grabbed at her blouse, but Jeremy sent him sprawling, then dragged her forward.
"Come on, move! Faster!"
She looked around her as she was propelled forward. They were on the tarmac of an aerodrome.
"Help!"
she screamed. Jeremy put a hand over her mouth as he forced her along. Alfie scrambled to his feet. His head still swam around, and he staggered after Phoebe like a drunken man.
Jeremy and Phoebe were heading for one of the Spitfires lined up beside the runway. With a supreme effort, he ran at them, swinging himself at Jeremy and trying to rugby tackle his legs.
"Let her go!" he shouted.
Jeremy turned and launched a vicious backhanded punch at him, sending him flying backward and hitting the ground hard.
"Don't you hurt Alfie, you horrid man!"
Phoebe screamed as his hand had slipped from her mouth. She grabbed that hand and sank her teeth into the soft flesh of his palm. Jeremy let out a roar of pain and instinctively snatched his hand away. Phoebe reached out for Alfie.
"Quick! Run!"
Jeremy drew a pistol, raised it, then said,
"What the hell? Go on, you little brats, go! No one can stop me now, anyway."
As the children ran toward a line of huts, they met an armored car driving toward them. It screeched to a halt, and airmen leaped out.
"Two children!" one of them shouted. "What the devil are you doing here?"
"You must stop him,"
Phoebe gasped, out of breath after their ordeal.
"Jeremy Prescott, he kidnapped us. He's a German spy."
"Is that right?" the first airman was grinning. "Is this some kind of dare?"
"No, of course not," Phoebe glared at him. "I'm Lady Phoebe Sutton, Lord Westrum's daughter, and we were kidnapped by Jeremy Prescott, and we think he was planning to shoot Winston Churchill. You can telephone Farley if you don't believe me, but first you should try to stop Jeremy Prescott before he does something awful. He just ran toward those aeroplanes."
Men's shouts made them look up. A Spitfire was taxiing toward the runway.
"He's stolen a plane!" an airman came running toward them. "He shot one of our blokes and took a Spitfire."
The plane's engine had become a roar. It raced down the runway and up into the sky.
"Now do you believe me?"
Phoebe asked triumphantly.
"You were very brave children,"
the camp commander said when they had repeated their story for the sixth or seventh time and were seated in his office drinking cups of tea.
"It's all over now. It's all right if you go ahead and cry, little lady."
Phoebe frowned at him and stuck out her chin.
"My father would not like me to cry in public. We're supposed to set an example."
She stood up.
"Do you think someone could telephone my parents and drive us home, please?"
It was when she arrived home that the tears finally came. Phoebe discovered that they hadn't even missed her.
"We thought you were staying out of the way in the schoolroom because you didn't want to get involved with the preparations this morning," Lady Esme said, "and because you don't like being polite to strangers at parties."
"But didn't the dogs come to get you?"
Phoebe said, the distress in her voice rising at her mother's calmness.
"I was sure they would."
Lady Westrum stared at her in horror.
"The dogs did come," she said. "They were barking and making an awful commotion right before the Churchills arrived. I had Soames take them inside and shut them up."
Then she suddenly did a most uncharacteristic thing and wrapped Phoebe into her arms.
"Oh, my poor little girl," she said. "You might have died." "I nearly did," Phoebe said. "If Alfie hadn't been jolly brave and tackled Jeremy, he might have flown with me to Germany, or he might have killed me."
And then, without warning, she burst into tears. When she had been calmed and sat beside her mother on the sofa, her father asked,
"My dear, why on earth didn't you come to us if you thought that someone was planning to shoot the Prime Minister?"
"I wasn't sure you'd believe me," Phoebe said. "Besides, we're supposed to report anything suspicious to authorities. It says so."
"To the authorities?" Lord Westrum blustered. "That bloody idiot in the village wouldn't know a spy if one leapt out and bit him."
"Don't swear in front of the children, Roddy," Lady Westrum said. "The child's bloody well been kidnapped by a rotten traitor and might have died, and you're worried about her hearing a swear word," he demanded. "What we should be doing is sending her off to a good boarding school where she has less time on her hands."
Phoebe glanced at Dido and grinned.
"How come she gets rewarded for taking stupid risks?" Dido said. "How about sending me off to finishing school? Or at the very least, let me go and drive a lorry?"
"Over my dead body," Lord Westrum said, "which it probably would be if anyone put you behind the wheel."
Alfie had been sitting, silent and uncomfortable, in the morning room, wishing he could go home. It was strange, but he now thought of the gamekeeper's lodge as home and found himself wondering if he'd ever want to go back to his mother in London, even if the war ended. He stood up.
"I should be getting back. Mrs. Robbins will be worried about me."
"Of course," Lady Westrum looked at him kindly. "Off you go, then. You're a brave young man. Thank you. Well done." At the doorway, Alfie paused and looked back.
"I found out about Baxter's yard. Do you know what he's building in there?"
"Coffins. Lots and lots of coffins."
"In readiness for the invasion," Lord Westrum said, "which now might be a little further off, thanks to what didn't happen today."
Lady Westrum looked around as if just noticing that one of her brood was missing.
"Is Pamma still with Ben?" Lady Westrum asked.
"Yes, she's still at the hospital," Margot said.
"He was awfully brave. I do hope he'll be all right."
"I expect he'll be glad he was able to do something for his country at last," Lord Westerham remarked.
Pamela sat beside Ben's bed in the hospital. His shoulder was bandaged. His face looked white, but he was propped up and wide awake.
"I can't believe it of Trixie," Pamela said. "It seems she was working for the Germans all along. She was stealing information at Bletchley."
"Why would she do that, I wonder?" Ben said.
"The thrill of it, I suppose. No doubt she'll tell us in time. It does seem that her father has always been pro-German, pro-Nazi. But Jeremy, what could have made him turn on us that way? Do you think they brainwashed or tortured him in Germany?"
"I wonder if it wasn't a twisted sense of patriotism. I gather that some people think that by ending the war now, it is sparing Britain from the destruction of our most precious monuments, even if it does mean being under Germany's domination."
Pamela shuddered.
"I don't think we'll ever know now," she said. "I wonder if he's flown to Germany in that plane. I suppose so."
They looked up as footsteps tapped across the tiled floor. A curtain was pulled back, and Guy Harcourt stood there.
"Oh, sorry. I'm not interrupting a tryst, am I?"
he asked with a mischievous smile on his face.
"Of course not. Come in, Guy," Pamela said.
Guy stood at the foot of the bed.
"How are you feeling, old chap?"
"As if a mule kicked my shoulder, but otherwise okay. I'm told I was lucky, and that the bullet went through nothing but muscle and out the other side."
"Damned lucky."
"Actually, I came with some good news.
Prescott's plane was shot down over the channel."
"Our Spitfires chased him and caught him?" Ben asked. Guy gave a wry smile.
"No, quite the opposite. He was shot down by Messerschmitts. Ironic, isn't it?"
Ben reached out and took Pamma's hand.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Poor Jeremy," Pamela sighed. "What a horrible end."
"It's how he'd have wanted to go, blazing out like a firework."
Ben stared past her, out the hospital window. In spite of everything, Jeremy had meant something to him too, been an important part of his life, whether he liked it or not. They remained silent while hospital noises went on in the background, the clatter of a trolley, the crisp voice of a nurse giving a command.
"I wonder why nobody picked up on that blighter Prescott before," Guy said.
"I suppose the enemy relied on the fact that they assumed nobody had survived that breakout to tell the truth about him."
"So the man who fell into our field had been sent to deliver a message to him, do you think?"
Pamela asked.
"Undoubtedly."
Ben glanced up at Guy and nodded.
That he carried nothing on him but the snapshot was a clear indication that he hadn't far to go. He didn't need money or a ration card or tools. Presumably, Jeremy had already arranged a place to hide him.
And the snapshot was the go-ahead for the date to kill Churchill, once their agents knew he'd be visiting a nearby aerodrome, Pamela said, putting the pieces together.
How did they know about the garden party at Farley? Guy asked. Shooting the PM in an aerodrome was surely a risky business.
It wasn't to be Farley when it was planned, Ben said. It was going to be Chartwell, but the PM nixed those plans, so the Westrams offered instead.
The message must have eventually been delivered by other means, Pamela went on. One of those radio messages that we were trying to decode, maybe.
He actually saw the photograph, Ben said. He came to aerial reconnaissance while I was there, and the photograph was lying, blown up on the table.
When was this? Guy asked.
A few days ago.
Oh, I think he must have had the whole thing planned earlier than that, Pamela said. The way Trixie offered to come down to help at the party, it was all planned out some time ago.
Guy nodded.
I agree. We actually think it was part of a bigger plan, put into orchestration the moment he came back to England. A plan to facilitate the invasion, return the Duke of Windsor, and assassinate the royal family, with Jeremy at the helm.
Pamela shuddered.
Don't, please. I can't bear to think about it.
She stood up.
I probably should be going. The family will worry about what has happened to me. Maybe Pa will let Margot drive over to pick me up.
I could give you a ride home, Guy said.
That's very kind of you.
She gave him that radiant smile that had so entranced Ben.
I'll just pop into the ladies' room, then. I'm sure you two have things to talk about that you can't say in front of me.
Sharp girl, Guy said as Pamela left the room. And a looker, too. I must say she's taking this remarkably calm, considering she was his girlfriend.
I think that party opened her eyes to his real nature, Ben said.
So now you step in and fill the vacuum, Guy grinned.
I'm not sure about that. She sees me as a brother.
Oh, I don't think the look she just gave you was at all sisterly, Guy said. Neither was the way she flung herself at you when you were shot.
Ben lay there, staring at the ceiling, feeling warm inside. There was hope. He'd bide his time, but there really was hope.
Then he remembered the unanswered question.
About Margot, do you think she is working for the Germans? Guy moved closer to him.
I shouldn't be telling you this, but she's working as a double agent at the moment, sending info back to the Germans, infiltrating meetings of the Ring, but keeping us apprised of what is going on. She had to pretend to go along with their plans, of course.
Oh, and she's asked to join Special Ops. She'll be going up to Scotland to train.
Crikey, Ben said. I'm so glad she wasn't part of this.
Well, it could have been much worse.
The Germans were trying to get her to kill the King at a garden party scheduled for this weekend. The King and Churchill gone in one fell swoop. But Buckingham Palace was bombed, so the event was cancelled. And, of course, she had no intention of carrying out the assignment,
but because she warned us about it, we'll be keeping an eye open for a future attempt. She's a brave girl. True blue.
Pamela returned. "Shall we?" she asked. She came over to Ben, leaned down, stroked back his hair, and kissed his forehead.
"I'll be back in the morning," she whispered.
And Guy was right.
The gaze that she gave him was not sisterly.
Chapter 40 At the Village Church. On Midsummer Day, the Reverend Cresswell held a special memorial service at the church in honour of Seaman Robbins. The whole village attended, as well as Lord Westrom's family and the staff at Farley. Mr. and Mrs. Robbins sat together in the front pew, holding hands, looking down at their hymn books as the choir and congregation sang, "O God, our help in ages past." Alfie sat beside them, feeling sad and proud at the same time. In the pew to one side, reserved for the Farley family servants, Miss Gumbel was deep in thought. If Phoebe was to be sent away to school, and she had already recommended a couple of first-class girls' schools that would make the most of Phoebe's good brain, then she would no longer be needed here. She had a good brain herself, and she might be able to be of use to her country. She wondered whom she could speak to about it. Ben had been released from hospital and was recuperating at home, being spoiled by Mrs. Finch. While he was still in hospital, he had received a visit from Maxwell Knight himself and been praised for his good work.
"I want to keep you on my books," Knight had said, "even if you are an Oxford man."
Pamela had come down from Bletchley for the occasion. She hadn't seen Trixie since her arrest and still found it hard to come to terms with what had happened. Had Trixie been recruited even before the war and gone to Bletchley originally as a spy, or had she been turned or threatened while she was there? Pamela realized she might never know. And as for Jeremy, it was too painful still to think about him. She supposed the wound would heal eventually. Instinctively, she glanced across at Ben to see that he was looking at her. And she smiled. Historical note. This is a work of fiction, but is closely rooted in the truth. There were several pro-German societies and organizations working in England at the start of World War II. One of the most dangerous was a group called the Link. It was composed mainly of aristocrats, and they believed that it would be in Britain's best interest to make peace with Germany before all the national treasures were destroyed. Whether they would have actively aided an invasion, nobody knows. Maxwell Knight really did run a secret branch of MI5 from his flat in Dolphin Square, under the name of Miss Copplestone. Joan Miller really was his secretary and a terrific spy herself, and he really did keep animals in his office. Bletchley Park was exactly as I have described it. You can visit it today and see the Spartan conditions under which such brilliant work was done. You may notice similarities between fashion designer Gigi Armand and Coco Chanel, who was able to live in the Ritz and survive the war, thanks to her being the mistress of a high-ranking German officer. Lord Westrom and Farley exist only in my imagination, but the location is in a real part of Kent, close to where I grew up and went to school. And I have drawn on two real stately homes in the neighbourhood, Penshurst Place and Knoll, both worth a visit. Winston Churchill's beloved Chartwell is also nearby. This has been an Audible Studios production of In Farley Field, written by Rhys Bowen, performed by Gemma Dawson. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2017 by Janet Quinn Harkin. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.